Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recovery plan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Tiffany. Delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I apologize. We had some technical difficulties with our first recording, but we're going to have you back a second time and certainly try to get this conversation warmed up again. Before we do that, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me again. Hopefully we can replicate the initial conversation and dive into this topic. So I'm Tiffany Williams. I am the founder and CEO of Givly. It's a giving and donor engagement platform that we recently launched a couple of months ago. And I also have a fundraising agency, TJ Marie Consulting, and we help nonprofits strengthen operations and raise money.
So tell me about this platform you're talking about. It's a new thing.
Yeah, it is a new thing. it's Givly. Givly is a mobile app. Essentially, we took some of the pain points that we saw in the industry and just in my 10 plus years of doing this work and created a platform that allows people to give in a way that fits their lives. So the way we transact with other, apps, four taps and we're done with the transaction, essentially. This is how we order food. This is how we, summons a car to come pick us up and take us somewhere. And so anyway, we just turned that kind of psychology into a donation app. And so essentially, for nonprofits, they can, send a quick message to their supporters and say, hey, we need to raise a quick $5,000 for something that we're doing. And can you pitch in $10? And then the donor can respond very easily in the app because their information is already saved. And so they don't have to, go typing in their name and their email address and all the good stuff you have to do when you're giving in traditional methods. And their payment information is already saved. And so they can quickly respond to those requests. There is a mechanism where donors, people like you and me, can set a giving goal. We believe in intentional philanthropy. So we set a giving goal, and then every time you make a donation through the app, it tracks your donations toward that giving goal. So, at the end of the year, hopefully you've satisfied your giving goal. And if not, you know you've got a little ways to go. So really cool features. You can learn more about it at givlyapp.com, givlyapp.com.
Fascinating. Well, yeah. I'll make sure to put some information about that in the show notes and all of our – well, I won't assume that all of our, but presumably the large majority of our listeners are working for nonprofit organizations. And I'm sure they'll be happy and excited to go check that out.
Yeah.
So, Tiffany, What's a big What's the subject we're going to talk about today? We always invite our guests to come with a big idea or bold opinion, and so what are we going to tackle today?
Today we're going to tackle the idea that nonprofits and the philanthropy sector and the fundraising sectors must address the inequities that exist within the sector in terms of mostly race.
So that can mean a lot of things.
That's a lot of things.
So I'm going to get.
There's a lot going on right now. People are starting to be to look inward, hopefully, at how, you know, the various sectors and in our professional lives and our personal lives, how we can address some of the inequities that exist. And so, because that conversation is happening in lots of other sectors, I thought, you know, this is my wheelhouse. And I think it's something we should discuss to try to see how we can get better here.
So are we talking, Tiffany, about the people in the fundraising roles? Are we talking about the individuals in the donor seat? Are we talking about someone else? Or perhaps we're just talking about all of those roles?
We're talking about all of the above.
they all sort of operate, in my mind, they sort of operate on different timelines. And I had this discussion recently with another guest on the podcast, and it's sort of the idea that, you know, who I hire tomorrow is a very different timeline in my mind than the wealthy philanthropist who has accumulated wealth over decades and now is able to contribute very generously to. So it's two different timelines to ensure that that person represents the diversity that we want it to represent.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think in my estimation, it's understanding, right? So we're not going to, you know, in the next year, undo the generations and generations of, you know, wealth disparity to make, you know, wealth equitable amongst all racial groups, right? That's not necessarily, it's impossible to do in the next month. But I do think it's important to understand and recognize and acknowledge why things are the way they are, because it's all connected. Right. So if you're talking about who is sitting at the table and being a philanthropic advisor or being a major gift officer or interacting in these circles, and you see disparities all up and down the board, right? Who's heading organizations, who has these relationships, it's important to understand the whys, because if we don't understand, how this happens and why this happens, you know, on a grander scale, we can't start fixing pieces of the puzzle. We don't understand what it, you know, what the whole thing should look like.
Okay. So in the next 12 months, what role can, in your mind, what role, given the current sort of climate that we're in, what role can we focus on to get the best bang for our buck in terms of sort of achieving a more diverse sort of role in these seats?
So I think the first thing is to read and acquire knowledge and understand. I think, you know, we move in such a fast-paced world that, you know, we, and especially like, you know, us as consultants, we go in, we analyze the situation, and immediately we're kind of like, oh, okay, this is what needs to happen. A, B, C, D, here are the recommendations. Let's get moving.
Yes.
And so we recognize issues and then we immediately try to solve for them. Right. But we immediately try to solve for them because we have historic knowledge, right? We have done that for many years. We have worked in, you know, other organizations that we can pull on in terms of our experience and our expertise. And so it's never easy, but it's easier when you know kind of what you're doing, right? I think, you know, what kind of concerns me a little bit about what's happening now is that it's kind of like, oh, there's a problem. Okay, like, let's jump into how to fix it, right?
Okay.
Instead of being like, let's understand it. So I would say the first thing is, you know, if you are a decision maker, if you are a leader, and you manage people or you're building something, like, understand, read. There's so many really great resources out there, you know, to explain kind of why these inequities exist. And so it's start with that fundamental piece, right? Get some knowledge, get some understanding. And then there are a number of other things, you know, that can be done. Looking at, you know, obviously, you know, who's being hired, right? To fill roles that exist, right? We talk a lot about company culture and organizational culture, right? And like who fits in to what we're already doing. The train is already moving. Who can jump on without any disruption in the process, right? Because nobody wants to, like, you know, disrupt the existing process. But what that does in a lot of businesses, if we don't recognize and if we're not careful, is we create the culture that already exists over and over again. And because we know that human psychology says we're most comfortable around people who are like us, then we tend to leave people out. Right. So that's another thing. But of course, it all goes back to, you know, making sure you read and understand that. And then it's not just about hiring, right? I think it's also about what type of support is being offered for people who might be different in a number of different ways, right? You know, it's not just kind of like diversity for the sake of diversity. Do we have a Black person at the table, right? But are we allowing people to question why things are the way they are without fear of retribution? Are we allowing people to bring their entire whole selves to the table and not, like, you know, the box that, you know, has already been established and then asking them to fit within that? So there are a number of different things we can do to start to move the needle on this, right? But I think, again, it all starts with being well-informed and then being honest with ourselves to understand how we have maybe even contributed to these disparities in the past. And those are tough conversations to have.
Okay. So is there a cohort of individuals, perhaps like yourself, who are ready to help some of these? So there's a whole, I've been working in the nonprofit sector for 2 decades. Perhaps you have too, as well. And there's a whole,
you're much older.
What's
than
that?
You're much older than me.
Okay. So that's fine. So, yeah, that's right. You said you were, I think you said you were about 10 years in. That's fine. Yeah. So there's a whole cohort of organizations out there that are led primarily by white folks that look like me. Their donors are white folks that look like me, and they're volunteer. You know, they're just a world of whiteness, right? And I guess my question for you is there an army ready to go? If I started a recruitment effort, a scouting effort to place non-white people in some of these roles, are these people ready to be the change agents inside these organizations? Because they're not going, some of these organizations I've interacted with over 2 decades, they're as white. Mm-hmm. And they're essentially opting to try to exist. I don't even know if that's the path they would want to take. I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
So I don't think there's like an army of people ready to go, right? And I don't know if I would say it's a fair, I guess, kind of assumption to think that people who have no, you know, like prior experience, or even if they do, right, that they exist for the purpose of transforming systems, right?
Sure. Yes.
And so I think that's part of, and we talk about this a lot in, like, you know, kind of like Black circles, especially, you know, corporate Black circles, kind of like, you know, this Black tax, right? So it's not a poll tax necessarily, but it's kind of like, if you're there, you are expected to be the, you know, I don't want to say like social justice warrior. I feel like that's kind of a bad word now.
You're expected to sort of play a part.
Come in and like have all the answers for all the inequities that exist, right? And I don't think that's fair either, right? I think it's kind of like, you know, these systems exist and, to be blunt, you know, it's kind of like, I say this all the time, like Black people didn't create racism. We don't benefit from racism.
Yes.
So it's really kind of not our job to dismantle racism, right?
Right.
So it really is going to take a collective and collaborative effort, and that effort must be led by white people. Now, Black people and, you know, Latinx people can speak to our real lived experiences, right? Because sometimes they're just blind spots, right? If it's not happening to you, it's hard to kind of see, right? So we can do a lot of that work. We can share our experiences, but it can't be a matter of kind of like, okay, yes, come in and fix these issues that have been, you know, historic and pressing, you know, for many years and generations. It's just not fair, but then it's very unlikely to happen in that way. So yes, people have to be intentional, and yeah, everybody has to constantly be working toward a more equitable sector in order for it to work. And it's a constant work, right? You don't get to like pick it up and put it down when it becomes hard or uncomfortable, because we don't get to do that. We don't get to like, you know, stop looking, you know, stop noticing how race affects our lives every day.
Can it be redeemed? I mean, I think about this organization I worked for. It was the second organization. This is 15 plus years ago. I was working on a capital campaign. Old Pennsylvania Dutch sort of organization up in the northeast corner of Pennsylvania. And I don't remember them being diverse at all, right? In terms of who their donors were, in terms of who they hired, and in terms of the kids that showed up for camp every summer. I think I compelled a donor when the second year I was there, that compelled a donor to create a scholarship program. And so the camp enrollment became a slightly more diverse, but it also became the assumption amongst the staff. You can assume that, you know, these were viewed as the kids that needed assistance, right, or yeah, whatever. You know what I mean? I mean, it was a typical,
yeah.
I wasn't there much longer after that. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I get it.
But can an organization like that be redeemed? I guess, yeah, is the question. I mean, because hiring a Black development director, for example, is going to set that individual in my mind up for failure in misery, quite honestly. And that organization is so rooted in its tradition, mm-hmm, and not a bad tradition. It's a faith tradition. It's a church. It's part of a church group, that I don't know that they can, and they're good people. That's the other thing. They're good people. So can they, and I bet they're reading. I know their leader, the gentleman who's there, the leader of the organization, mm-hmm, but I don't know that they can be redeemed in the sense that,
well, there's something that needs to be fixed, but I think so. Let's kind of like start from the beginning of this issue, this topic of diversity in terms of like, you know, homogenous communities or
right. Cause that's, I mean, that's the, yeah, example of what it is. I mean, it's a homogenous community, yeah, and anything that's homogenous risks, a lot of people don't understand that ecology teaches us that the more homogenous a environment is, the more likely it is to collapse. So an organization like this doesn't even realize that in some ways the lack of diversity is a risk.
Okay.
They don't see it that they don't see it that way, not because they wouldn't care to see it that way or wouldn't believe it. It's just, they just don't.
Yeah.
So
that was, so I'm glad you brought that up, because I think, you know, anytime there is, you know, like you walk in cause you're used to diversity and you're used to, you know, and then you're kind of like, oh, this is like super not right.
But I
think that it goes back to diversity. So this issue of diversity and like, you know, when I talk to other people in like corporate spaces and say like, okay, and I'll say, oh, we need to be diverse. I always say, why? Like, what is it? Like, what, why do you want to embark upon this journey and like do all of this work? And it's hard and it's tough and it's going to be a challenge and it's going to challenge some of your beliefs about yourselves and blah, blah, blah. Right. So why do you even want to do that? Right. So I think that, you know, it can't just be because it looks bad that we're not, you know,
yeah, right,
like there has to be a why there. And because that's what you're going to have to keep going back to when things get really tough. Like, what was the original, you know, why do we set out to do this in the first place? And I think that unless companies understand and realize the value add of diversity, like there's no incentive to do anything different. If we are successful and we are like moving along our merry way, and there is no, you know, we have our, you know, fair share of challenges like every organization does, but there's nothing that is like so big and insurmountable that we need a, you know, significant change to happen. Why would we not just continue doing the thing that we've been doing, been successful at it? Right. So I think that it has to be, you know, if there is an organization that is completely comfortable where it is and they do not necessarily see, you know, having to add somebody, you know, different, you know, to their little, their mix, you know, then I would say like, yeah, don't put somebody through that if you're not, if you don't have a real reason, because you won't be willing to do the work. So I don't know if this question is kind of like, I think any institution can be redeemed. I think the question is there the will?
Yeah.
And sometimes redemption or, you know, changing something comes with considerable sacrifice. So, you know, is there a will to sacrifice?
Right.
To get to whatever the goal is.
You know, if you go back to your use of the word homogenous, or if we talk about any sort of monoculture, you know, we can look at I read an article not too long ago about almonds in California, for example. And when you grow a monoculture, when you risk What you risk is collapse of that. If a beetle comes through, for example, and has the means to sort of destroy your crop, it'll do that. But monocultures are also highly, highly efficient. Mm-hmm. And so that gets to your notion of sacrifice. Some of what I think the nonprofit sector has to be willing to let go of is some of the efficiency that they've become very accustomed to. So I think, for example, diversifying our donor base has a lot of potential. But for example, when it comes to direct response, your response rates are going to have to, you know, you're going to have to spend a little bit more money, and the efficiency of that direct mail program is not going to be as high if you want to have different types of donors coming through that direct mail stream. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to take doing, right? But, you know, again, I think it goes back to kind of like, you know, is it worth it to do it? And I think, you know, we mentioned this in our last conversation. There's this notion that people want to believe that they are inherently good, right? And I'm not here to argue whether or not people are, but I want to say that I believe that there is a belief that people want to be, right?
Yes, so, definitely.
There's this recurring theme in movies that are set like in the civil rights era or even later, right? So, you know, it's, you know, era of slavery. And there's always kind of like a good white person, right? And even in like real stories, like we know that there were like, you know, white people that helped progress, you know, the cause and, you know, all this kind of great stuff. But even in real stories, if a white person did not exist in that role, they would create one for the movie, right? And the reason why is because people wanted to see themselves as being that person, not the other terrible people who were involved. You know, they wouldn't see themselves as that person. You don't want to believe that they would have been that person. And so my question is always, what are you doing today? Because there are opportunities to be that person all around us, right? You know, whoever you think you would have been in the civil rights movement, whoever you are today is who you would have been then,
right? Yes.
And so, so are you doing anything now that would give an indication that you would have been out sacrificing yourself for some greater, you know, noble cause? And if the answer is no, I'm not doing too much, then that's who you would have been in the civil rights movement. And that's who you would have been in the you know, 1700s, 1800s.
Yeah, I've been reading. I've got a number of, I'm working on this book project that I repeatedly reference, and because it's just sort of consuming, if I'm not podcasting, not working with a client, I'm working on this book. But I'm looking at cultural context within a culture. So within one culture, so not we're not looking at, say, an English speaking American versus the Japanese. We're talking about Americans within, you know, English speaking Americans. Mm-hmm. And there's different cultural contexts that sort of happen within that. And I think about Tiffany, and I think I shared my experiences with you about this before. So Danielle was my boss when I was at the health charity in Washington, and Danielle is a Black woman, and she and I would travel together. And essentially what we carried with us, it was interesting, and I think back on this and I reflect on this a lot. Essentially, we carried with us two cultural contexts everywhere we went, because she was a Black woman and I was a white man, and we traveled around the country and we interacted with these donors, and they themselves had different cultural contexts. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of afforded a perspective for my professional development, because I was about 10 years in. This was my first major gift role. And I recently shared this story with a podcast guest, this couple that we interacted with in New York City on Fifth Avenue, you know, penthouse apartment, probably had more wealth than any of us can even imagine having. And race was not, you know, Danielle and I, we did fine. But when you put these different cultural contexts, when you put these different lenses, like, you know, lived experiences, stories together, it's very interesting. And I guess the question is does the nonprofit sector want the richness of sort of bringing together those stories? I mean, I think about that Fifth Avenue. It was a couple of meetings, but we were forming relationships across cultural lines, also on a shared, you know, in the interest of this health charity. This wasn't an organization that was trying to fight, you know, a diversity, equity, inclusion sort of initiative. But we were able to cross some of those lines in the process of achieving a common goal. And I just wonder, is there enough organizations out there that want to do that?
I hope so. You know, I think that, you know, there's a hesitation to put people in situations where we even think that there might not be a good quote unquote fit, right? So it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, our donors are mostly like this. So we need to make sure that we put in somebody who's mostly like them, because it will make them more comfortable. And, you know, it will, you know, there won't be like a, you know, shock to the system. Right. You know, as someone who has, you know, worked with organizations all across the country and Canada and, you know, been in some very wealthy spaces, I think, you know, there is a certain curiosity, I think, that I bring to, you know, the table, right? Like people want to know, like, oh, they will say you're different, but it's kind of like, oh, well, where are you from? And like, where did you grow up? And what's been your experience? Because it's not the same as everything else that they may have seen, right? And so certainly, you know, as you say, you know, the cross-cultural, you know, interest has been I could tell many stories about, you know, where, you know, even it was kind of like, oh, the kind of a shock. I even had a donor tell the development director at this place, and it was very homogenous. Did you know the consultant was Black? And so she's like, well, yeah, I know she's Black, you know, but it was just, he had not worked with a person to talk about his money before who was Black. And it was, you know, it was kind of a shock to him. But anyway, so I can tell stories and stories of, like, you know, situations where bringing something different was absolutely a value add. And I won't say that, you know, like he gave more money because I was Black. That's not the case, but it certainly was not the big scary thing that may have been the initial thought, right? I did my job, and, you know, we were able to build a good, you know, report, and it was all good, you know? So I think, so part of that, so you say, like, are there organizations who are willing to, well, so the question is, are there organizations out there, and I believe they are, who have a little bravery? And who are, well, you know, if we talk about what we aspire to do as people who work in the nonprofit sector, okay? So think about, you know, like just generally the premise of this space.
Yeah, like why we exist. Exactly. I know where you're going.
Like, if anybody should be doing this, if anybody should be moving the needle to make the world and the country a better place, this is it. You know, how no other sector should be leading this charge before this one. Because that's why we exist in the world.
That's right. That's right. And I tell my students that over at the college, I say, if, you know, when the world, when nothing in the world makes sense, when nothing, in, you know, when the private sector, when Walmart and Target and McDonald's have all let us down, and when the government can't fix the problems, that's the opportunities for the nonprofit sector, the third sector, to sort of step up and fill in a lot of those needs. And but I think the problem is that the nonprofit sector has been behaving like those other two, like they're two big brothers or something, for so long that we haven't. What's that?
I said, well, now you're preaching a word. That's what we say in the South, in the old Southern Baptist.
Yes.
You're preaching a word.
Yeah. I think for so long we've been behaving like those other shops, that we don't know how, and even the way that we would approach diversity, equity, and inclusion, we don't even know how to approach that correctly, because we're just looking at the way that Walmart approaches it or Target approaches it,
right?
Or somebody in Washington says we should approach it. But perhaps there is a way, that could be unique to us, that we could demonstrate a capability. I just bring it back to this notion of efficiency. I have gone gangbusters on picking on efficiency. I think we inherited efficiency as sort of this primary sort of virtue, this cardinal virtue from the Industrial Revolution, over 100 years ago. And efficiency is not going to be the thing that if any goal that you and I would try to encourage a client, for example, to achieve, it's not going to feel efficient. Mm-hmm. Because initially it's going to be messy. It's going to be uncertain. It's not going to be very predictable. There's going to have to be, like, to use your word, sacrifices. We're going to have to forego some things. I remember introducing a candidate to a client I won't name the community, but one of the candidates was an African-American woman, and they would not consider her a legitimate candidate. It frustrated the jeebies out of me. And she was a talented young woman, and I knew she could do this major gift work. And she took it in stride, and I suspect she's doing just fine and found another opportunity. But I think that willingness, you know, that willingness to sort of take that risk, if that's what they saw it as, is some of that, getting back to that word redemption.
Jason, you know, there's not a single institution in American society that at its root, at its foundation, at its infancy did not or does not have racism embedded. Right. Like the housing, policing, education, philanthropy, business. There is not one. Right. Even religion. I mean, I can point to specific cultural, like deeply embedded, rooted, historical facts that that intertwined with however it came to be. However it developed, was at its root this disease of racism, right? And so I think that if someone, you know, and that's why I keep going back to kind of like having an understanding, right? But if someone thinks that with that knowledge, that getting to untangle it all over generations and hundreds of years of the, you know, of these institutions, if someone thinks that is going to be an easy thing to do, to dismantle, or, you know, even an efficient thing to do, then
right.
I gotta say, they're just fooling yourself. It's not, right. You know, because you can't, it's like unbaking a pie, you know, like it's, and that's an impossible thing to do, but just, you know, just think about it. We've already mixed all the ingredients. It's already been in the oven. We've already done all this kind of stuff. So, you know, some of these things are going to have to be, you have to just start over. Some of these things are going to take like real sustained efforts to come to a better place. And I think that people must like know and understand that before kind of, you know, embarking upon a journey to like, you know, knock down the whites only sign in the movie.
Okay. So do we know, individuals like yourself and perhaps myself, do we know, are we wise enough to know that some of those organizations are just going to go away?
Yeah.
I mean, even in the private sector, you know, most businesses don't survive 50 years. You know, unless you're General Electric or something, you just don't exist forever. And so in some ways, do we just need to sort of be content with the idea that some of these organizations and maybe situate, you know, economic sort of rumblings like we're experiencing now with COVID and stuff is actually part of sort of that process that sort of weans out the survivors from the non-survivors. And we're not talking about this in a human sense. We're talking about this in a corporate sense. But some of these organizations just aren't going to survive.
Right.
And sometimes we just need to sort of give them a pass and not sort of fight. I guess what I'm saying is there enough of us out there that are saying we need to choose our battles well?
Yeah. So are some organizations not going to survive if they don't come along?
Well, like the organization I was referring to earlier that I worked for. I don't think there's a lot you can do about that. I don't think you're going to fix that, and I don't think I'm going to prop up a consulting company to try to help them fix that because I don't think they're going to pay me much to do it.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of stuff out there. Like I could, you know, you and I could probably compile some really good content and work on a great book that would sort of convince them. But I don't know that fight is a fight that needs to be fought.
Yeah. So it's just like how we tell our clients when we talk about donors, right? It's kind of like, you know, focus your time where you can get, you know, movement.
Yeah.
Right. Or like, you know, focus your time on, instead of trying to convince somebody to like your organization who has shown that they are not interested, like focus on the people who are interested and then add to that pipeline and dig deeper with them and all that kind of great stuff. So yes, you know, like short answer, absolutely. You focus where we can get movement. And, you know, here's the thing, like things are going to change. And things are changing constantly.
Right.
So are either going to be standing on the sidelines, watching the change happen, not changing, and then you're going to get left behind, right? Or you are going to be a part of it, right? And say, hey, like, what can we do? We recognize this as an issue. How can we begin to think about how we can contribute to the change we want to see happen, right? And then you know, organizationally or individually, you start to do some things that, you know, change and, you know, for the better or whatever, right? You grow. Or you're going to say, you know, this is not, I see the change happening. I don't want to be a part of it. And so we can just kind of, you know, dismantle or whatever, right? Like, so there are options. But I don't think that it is sustainable to believe that, you know, you can continue doing, or that organizations or even people can continue doing what's, you know, historically been comfortable and then, you know, continue existing on, you know, as we move forward. Now I caution that though, because I do think, you know, sometimes I look and I'm like, how has this institution lasted for so long, you know, being the way that it is, right? And it's frustrating.
I think if I'm following that sort of that angst, I think that's context. I think we have to, in the nonprofit sector, recognize that the last 50 years since World War II have been a period of relatively a continuous positive growth, and the nonprofit sector has expanded exponentially. And so the last 50 years probably isn't the best sort of context to think that every organization on the planet is survivable. I think some of the time that we're about to step into now will challenge and will result in some of the healthy diversity that you and I might want these organizations to have. I don't think these organizations are as robust and resilient as they think they are. and so, you know, I heard somebody else who very, very popular podcast guest sort of talking about this in the very macro sort of economic sense, that the boomers and their parents have sort of lived through a time period where the economic, you know, there's a lot of things that those of us who are younger, the Gen X and younger, and the millennials, for example, who are sort of moving in and playing a lot of the leadership roles now in the workplace. We're like asking the question, how did people do this? Mm-hmm. Like, how did you do this? How did you go on those two beach vacations? How did you own two homes? How did you own that many cars? How did you, you know, and so I think the economics of the sort of the world are changing.
And, are they changing for the better?
Oh, well, I think so, because I think about my four kids, for example, Tiffany. I got four kids that grew up in a world. I mean, President Obama is the first president that they think of. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they think of him as a black president. They just think of him as the president, yeah, right?
As a little.
And I've got a 16-year-old daughter who has essentially come of age, if you will, as a young woman in the Me Too era, right? I think of just sort of their sort of trajectory into the world as young adults, and the awareness that sort of has been both forced upon them, but also in a healthy way and sometimes in a disturbing way. And I just think they're going to see the world differently.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to see it more positively. They know, I mean, my kids are just as terrible as any other group of kids, but they pick up on things. And some of this is because they knew who their parent, you know, because of their parents, and we pick up on things and we overthink things sometimes. But I think, you know, and I don't know if you have kids, but I think there's a lot of people out there like myself and my wife and I, who sort of are looking at this next generation and the next generation after that, and thinking that, yes, the world has changed, and right now it feels very messy and uncomfortable. Because for example, my kids know that Danielle, the woman I was referring to that I worked for in Washington, D.C., they know that Danielle was probably the single most, she probably invested in me in the most significant and meaningful way as anybody in my career. And that, I think, those types of things, my kids knowing those types of things, is going to change the way that they see, like if they're in the room with you, they're going to look at you differently. I don't think they're just going to look at you like you're a black woman, you mm-hmm. know, they need to see, I think they need to see you as perhaps as a black woman, but also as more than a, you know, whatever you want them to, you know, as you get to know them, those sorts of things.
Jason, I am optimistic about, I'm sorry, about the generations, you know, after me. I mean, I don't have kids. I have two nephews. And I am hopeful, right? And I see them being more comfortable in diverse circles. Tons of research shows that they are more open. They're more, you know, accepting and celebratory of differences and all that kind of great stuff. And I think it's great. And I think, you know, I hope that that continues to be, you know, as they grow older. And by all indications, that is what will happen, right? But I also think that we are, as a society, more polarized, right? So depending on the kind of the family you grew up in, or where you grew up, what part of the country even, you know, that is, you know, that plays a part in how you perceive the world around you. I think we talked about, you know, like, you know, disparities and like income disparities and wealth disparities, like those gaps are growing bigger, right? Yeah. When 2009 happened and everybody was like, you know, like devastated, we always say like, you know, when America catches a cold, Black America catches the flu. And we see this over and over and over again. So we say like, okay, all of this like Black wealth was wiped away. And then there was a recovery, but guess who didn't recover?
Right.
You know what I mean? Or like even COVID, we're seeing significant disparities in who is dying from it. You know, so my nephews, while they grow up, while they are growing up in a society that is more, you know, or in a generation that is more accepting, more diverse, but they're also seeing police brutality on video and over again on loop. You know, they're also seeing, you know, they're entering into, you know, new workplaces and they're seeing how things are different than maybe what they imagine because their generation sees things one way, but they're stepping into, you know, settings where their generation is not in charge. Right. And so, you know, they're grappling with these challenges still. And it's, that is the part that kind of saddens me, right? Because I know that, you know, what we go out and what I'm talking to you about, and I'm writing blog posts about, you know, like all these things. My hope is that, you know, generations beyond me don't have to be writing these blog posts about these things, you know, that we will have fixed the things that need to be fixed, or we'll be so much further along. And I worry sometimes that we are not. And that, you know, it's ebbs and flows. You feel like we make a little progress and then you're like, oh, my God.
But Tiffany, that may be. See, I blame the efficiency there, too. You expect this. You know, we can't snap our fingers. I mean, it took us 400 years. It took us 400 years to get to the absolute disgusting mess that we're in now. And it may take the same 400 years to get us back to a place where we want to be. And so some of us.
What do you mean back to the place that we want to be, though? We never have been there.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. Forgive me. Yeah. Back. It's fun. Yeah. I get in trouble sometimes. Sometimes my commenters tell me the words I shouldn't use back. And I didn't know back was going to get me in trouble there. But yeah, to the place we want to be. Right. Mm-hmm. If it took us. And I think that that's why I sort of push back on the notion of sort of the nonprofit sector has sort of come of age in the last 50 years at a time, and we've sort of become professionals at a time when economic prosperity was relatively high and all of the mess that we're dealing with now was relatively, you know, was strong. And so what we're going to have to do is you and I, as young adults, are going to have to be okay with the fact that some of this may not remedy itself for another 50 years.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, and we're just going to have to sort of stick in our heels. But at the same time, I think people like yourself and myself also have to be very careful. One of the things that's frustrating me is I'm watching a lot of my peers, my white male peers, for example, in our space, being what we call very performative, for example. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're really, that's a load of crap, you know? And I think some of the genuine vulnerability that a guy like me can, and I'm not trying to sound arrogant here, but a guy, you know, create some space like we have with this podcast, have people on here, have meaningful conversations. I think those are the things that actually can sort of bring to light some of the opportunities more than, branding and marketing with diversity, equity, inclusion on it. I think that's what people like, you know, people on the, you know, that's what I'd like to hear more from sort of your side of the table, people on your side of the table saying is don't use me as a branding and marketing tactic.
For sure. Absolutely. And I think it's so, you know, I say this often and I said it on a LinkedIn comment on somebody's like, this is, you know, the I love the little, you know, Black Lives Matter, or like, you know, we stand for diversity and all this kind of crazy. Right. But it's kind of like, then I go, I looked at your board and there is no diversity.
Right.
I know your practices and I know that when things happen, you turn a blind eye to them, or, you know, and so that's the part of the frustrating thing. And I keep saying, I hope that this moment goes beyond the performative aspects of like, oh, you know, we want to be more diverse. Let's bring in a diversity and inclusion speaker and let's, you know, have them talk to us. And but then you go and do, you know, go back to doing the same comfortable things. And so I'm with you. I hope that these conversations are sustained, right? And so when we think about kind of like, it's not just bringing in diversity. It's not just, you know, saying that, you know, you stand for justice and equality for all. It is, what are you actively doing to dismantle, right? So it's not just, you know, we vow to be not racist, but are you anti-racist? Are you actively dismantling?
But isn't that okay? But this is, I just had this conversation with somebody offline about this, about the podcast, for example. Okay. Because this is an unscripted show, for example. And what I said to them is I said, in order for me to just deliver, like have a diverse and equitable and an inclusive show, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to be okay with periodically being vulnerable and oftentimes saying stupid stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's just going to come with it because yeah. it's not performative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we have to understand about using sort of the current climate as a marketing gimmick. Because it's going to come across clean and smooth, and that fella's going to say all the right stuff. Whereas,
he's going to say it.
whereas me and yeah. you having this conversation, I'm going to probably, and I've done this with donors. I think this is actually what gets us in trouble in fundraising is we're so quote unquote performative in the context of fundraising that we don't know how to have real conversations where we make ourselves vulnerable. And consequently say stupid things every once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, saying stupid things is a part of being a human being.
Human being.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we have to allow people space to learn, right?
Yes.
I mean, if what I said 10 years ago was recorded and... you know, you played it by.
I'm glad what I said 10 years ago wasn't recorded.
Oh no, don't have her on your podcast, right? So we live and we grow, and I think it's important to give each other space when we see that we're trying to come to a better place with each other, right? I think that's you know absolutely important. I will say that the issue of like. You know, like efficiency, wanting something. I'm going to use that so much now, Jason. I'm glad you introduced me.
Good. You can have it. You can have it. I will help you. Every time you say it, I will repost it.
This issue of like efficiency and like wanting like what we want. So for me, I think there's a balance of like, you know, obviously, you know, one of my favorite clients, I never, you know, have... all of my clients are favorite, but this is certainly one of my favorite clients, was the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture. And I would, you know, was helping them, you know, do some stuff and it was a great partnership. But so I would go down into the galleries. If you've never been to the museum, you should absolutely go for anybody who's listening in DC, on the National Mall. And I would like, you know, like take breaks and go down into the galleries and I would look at, you know, these pictures and like read these,
yeah.
books, listen to these voices and, you know, all this kind of great stuff. And it's just kind of like, you know, the things that you all were fighting for, like, obviously we have made progress, right? You know, like I'm yeah. looking at, you know, then and now, and I'm also looking at how much further we have to go, right? And so yeah. I think for me, it's kind of like, be, you know, like grounding yourself sometimes and kind of like, you know, coming to an understanding of kind of like, okay, we, you know, we've come away, we have so much longer to go. But then also it's kind of like, how long is, you know, at some point you got to demand the thing that needs to happen now, right? You got to be like, you know, the time for justice is always right now. You know, and so I wrestle with that a lot. I wrestle with kind of like, how much longer do we have to do this? You know, and the, you know, generations before me that were also doing this, you know, versus, you know, we know that this is not going to take, you know, that this won't be an overnight or over month or over generation or over lifetime thing. I wrestle with it. It's frustrating for me.
Yeah, I think you and I and our generation is going to live long. I think every generation, I mean, healthcare is pretty darn good. I think we're going to live a pretty good, you know, a good 50 more years and be able to work. And I think it's going to be an interesting, I think when my children and my grandchildren sort of come through, I think it's going to be an interesting sort of world to see. And I don't think we will have sort of worked it all out. Yeah. But I think, you know, one of the, we use the term with our consulting team, we use the term messiness. I think some of us have got to get comfortable with the messiness and the unpredictability. So if you attach, I love that you appreciate the word efficiency, but if you attach predictability and control next to it, you start to really see what is the problem in our sort of our very mechanical world. We want it to be very efficient, predictable, and controlled. And when you start appealing to different audiences and when you start hiring people who don't think and look and act like you and all those sorts of things, the world doesn't feel very efficient, very predictable and controlled. But in reality, COVID-19 has just all punched us in the gut and said the world isn't very, you know, predictable. And so I think that's...
Yeah, we have no control, do we?
Yeah, we don't have much control anyway. There's not a lot. We think we're... that's how one author I'm reading, you know, the way we achieve control is by exploiting and manipulating other people. Mm. That's essentially. And so if you look at, if you want to understand institutional racism, you basically go back to, you know, we basically look at ways that the world has been designed to basically control and manipulate other people. And that's just evil. And I don't think fundraising needs to look like anything like that. And the nonprofit sector as a whole, you know, certainly doesn't either.
Yeah. But how do we, you know, like solve for that? You know, I was reading an article in the New York Times the other day, and it was talking about how, you know, organizations that are led by Black and Latino people receive significantly less funding, even if all of the metrics are the same, like the impact metrics and how many people, you know, they're serving or where they're located and all that kind of great stuff. You know, when you talk about like where are the dollars being funneled. You know, that's why I say it's not just like the one thing, because even these organizations that at their head, at their top have, that diversity, check mark. You think about the resources that they have to do their jobs and how we allocate, resources to them. There's still a significant disparity there. So they have to do more with less. They have to do more. They are more stressed considering, so then we're talking about, how philanthropic dollars are allocated.
Well, but isn't that the test too? Maybe, you and I together, two individuals are sort of, putting this on the table. I mean, think about it. There's plenty of foundations and there's plenty of people in the philanthropic world who do the giving that are being performative as well. Sure, they're stepping up to the plate now, but is that sustainable funding? None of these organizations, whoever they are, who are trying to solve the world's problems are going to solve them in the next 6 months. So I appreciate that you're going to write checks to a more diverse pool of, beneficiaries this month. But if that generosity is not sustained over the next 5 years, some of these foundations were pulling the same stunts that some of these branding and marketing gimmicks are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I see that.
You have to solve for that though. Right. So it's kind of like, how do we know and how do we measure and how do we, and again, I think this is when we talk about the sustained kind of foot on the gas on this thing, right? I don't want it to just like disappear next month and we are, we're back out and, doing the things that we,
that we were doing a year ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the, I think this performative thing, I read about that. I mean, it's certainly been a notion that I sort of understand conceptually, but I had to sort of put, I'm sure we all are quite performative sometimes. And I think that's something that we've got to become more aware of, because I think there's a lot of money that is flowing into more diverse areas right now that's not sustainable. And I think that's ultimate. I think that has to be tested and evaluated with metrics that are much more long-term. Mm-hmm. And so I don't even know if that's a terribly, I wouldn't get, I speaking for myself, I would just say that I don't think we need to get too hung up on that in the short term. That needs to be a long-term sustainable problem. You know, test that out in 5 years.
Well, I think, you know, when we talk about like, you know, how the money flows, this is like, you know, pre, you know, racial, I don't know if it's like racial uprising, because it's, you know, bringing to the forefront something.
Pre last six months, right? Yeah.
So, but I mean, just like general, the, just in general, when we think about where, you know, where the philanthropic dollars flow, and I think I said this on, you know, in a previous conversation with you, it's kind of like, you know, and it was probably very controversial, but like even philanthropy is at its, you know, in its roots and core, it's
yes,
white supremacy.
That's like, fine. Yes,
you think about where the money exists, and then how that money gets allocated. You think about, you know, who has the power, control, resources, and when you have those things, you get to decide, right? Where, you know, what missions you want to invest in. Where you want to see impact happen, how much impact you want to see happen. When you don't have that, you don't have the same leverage, right? You don't get to
call your fellow
financiers.
And Tiffany, that's the conversation I like to have with individuals like yourself. So if I'm talking to a Black woman, for example, who's in a fundraising role, I like to assert to her, look, that old white guy who's got all that wealth that you're referring to as philanthropy, right, is not going to change. And he makes his decisions. He makes his decisions with people that sit across the lunch table from him. And so if the African-American major gift officer is not sitting across the table from that old white guy who's got all this wealth, there's not going to be any short-term change in my book.
So are you saying that the Black fundraiser,
yes,
the Black fundraiser across the table, or that is not that the Black fundraiser is not going to, you know, kind of inherently be in those circles, and so it's kind of a fool's errand to.
I'm saying that the Black fundraiser has to insist on the lunch table. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that I think there's too many of us, and this is my critique on the way fundraising gets done. I think there's too much fundraising getting done. So this is nothing to do with who's doing the fundraising. Too much fundraising is done at arm's length. Arm's length being in the mail, special events, grant writing, those sorts of things. And what I'm saying, and what anybody who's ever been a client or regular listener on the podcast knows, that I'm saying that all of the most significant sustainable fundraising gets done across a lunch table, mm-hmm. hypothetically. It's face-to-face conversation. Mm-hmm. And so if the Black fundraiser wants to make an impact in this for their organization or for the greater good or whatever, they're going to have to be sitting across the table. And for the time being, they're going to have to be sitting across the table. They're going to have to learn to be comfortable with the fact that for the time being, the person sitting on the other side of the table is going to be a very rich white guy.
Yeah. So I will say this as a Black fundraiser. I think I'm going to agree with you on, yes, like that across the table is, you know, and building relationships is absolutely where real fundraising happens. Or what, because you're developing relationships, right? Like you are, you know, getting to know people, and we, you know, people give to people, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the idea that like, you know, the Black fundraiser has to be comfortable doing that. I'm going to say that I think that institutions have to be comfortable sending or supporting Black fundraisers in their work, because I know a number of Black fundraisers, and we, you know, we will talk to anybody about most things, right? And so I kind of argue a little bit that it's not an issue of Black people not being comfortable doing it or even insisting that.
Oh yeah, I totally right.
I think I, that
people, yes,
you know,
yes.
Leadership has to say this is, you know, this is who we have. They're really good at the thing that they do. And we're going to allow that person to, you know, build a relationship because that's what we hired them to do. Right. I think that it happens. I think it can happen more. And I think that we have to, you know, as, you know, kind of veterans in this thing, we have to provide support for people who, you know, are like venturing out. Cause essentially it's kind of like we're like, you know, sending people out to like, you know, like do this work. And then we don't know, kind of, we're afraid to have the conversations afterwards about what it was like, or if they need something from us to make it a good, you know, thing. Was race, I don't even know if I've ever been like, was race even brought up in this, you know, in this thing? Or like, did, or like when the young man, or he wasn't a young man, he's an old man, said, did you know she was Black? You know, and nobody ever asked me about it or how I felt about it, or did I feel comfortable being, you know, with him after the fact, you know? And it's kind of like, we don't want to talk, you know, it's kind of an unsaid thing. We don't really want to talk about it, but we know it happened, you know?
I agree with you 110%. I think absolutely we have got to create organizations that understand. Yeah, right. You're right. There's plenty of, perhaps you're saying that there's plenty of Black women, for example, that will sit in that seat across the lunch table from that person who has more wealth than they have and doesn't look and think and live in the world that they do. But what I guess what I'm saying to the Black woman is I'm saying to them, you have to insist on that job. And I don't think that there's enough. I think there's plenty of white guys like me who are insisting on having that job, who are saying, I want the job that's going to put me in front of the donor who's got the wealth to write the big checks. And I think there has to be more non-white males who are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I think our profession, and I think this is what you and I talked about on the previous recording, I think our profession has got a lot of people who are quite content doing other types of fundraising by what is perhaps called extension. So they're relying on these other methodologies to generate resources. And then the white guy like me knows, look, if I want to bring home a big check, I'm going to have to take somebody out to lunch. And if I'm uncomfortable with that person because that person doesn't look or think or act like me, or might say I'm, you know, it's the same vulnerability. It's the same lack of being able to be performative. Sitting across the lunch table, if it's being done right, is not performative. Mm-hmm. Right. You just have to, presumably, you both show up and you're real. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what fundraising owes itself. Yeah. But I agree with you 100%. It is the culture. I wouldn't want anyone, be it a Black woman or a white guy or anybody else, to be working for an organization that doesn't know how to create that organizational character, that when you come back to the office and that meeting didn't go very well, you can process it with that someone.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard to do, especially when it's an issue of race. And I think that so many times we kind of take on this, you know, like we don't want to always be bringing up race. We want to just like do our jobs like everybody else and like not always be like, well, this thing, and I couldn't really tell, which is why we have our, you know, we have our little groups that we have to talk about. Like, was it me or was that a thing, you know? And it's hard to do. And I think that it has to be, you know, that's why, you know, it has to be a collective effort. I will also say too, I think that's why mentorship is so important in these roles, right? Because, you know, I, you know, didn't have somebody to reach out to after, you know, somebody even just kind of like higher up in the company who was, you know, a Black woman to say, hey, you know, what am I supposed to do here? You know, there was literally nobody. There was nobody. And so I think that's, you know, again, why it's so important to have those mentors and people in place who can, like, you know, make sure that people are getting the support they need. Because someone's, as you know, there's this notion of kind of like, it's kind of like weathering, but it's also kind of like corporate fatigue and ethnic fatigue. You know, it's kind of like, you know, we, as a person who has for a considerable part of life, been in spaces where you were the only one over and over again all the time? You were always the other. That is heavy, you know? Like it's it, because you feel like you carry the entire, you know, race and, you know, whatever on your shoulders, right? You got to like jump twice as high. You got to be twice as good. You got to get up twice as early. You got to, you know, because everybody is looking for you to like, you know, represent the whole of Black women when obviously like we're not a monolith. We're not all the same, right? But that is just, you know, it's just kind of like the way things are. And so it's hard. I think it's really, it's difficult and it requires, you know, like taking a break, I think, a little bit sometimes from it too, you know? It's a balance. It's a balancing.
Well, I think I hear that. I think about the articles that I've read on social, you know, I think about some of the communication that's coming from the Black community in the last several months. And I think there's people that are stepping up and saying that, you know, you, Tiffany, shouldn't feel like you sort of have to take this on as the person who sort of, if you're the only, for example, if you're the only Black woman on the payroll, for example, you shouldn't have to feel like you got to play this role that sort of fixes all the institutional racism that's embedded in that organization. And I think that's, I think I would say that I've probably heard that narrative, which is a very healthy and sound narrative. I think I've heard that probably more in the last 6 months than I've ever, I don't know that I've ever even occurred. That's a much occurred to most of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for that reason, and for reasons like that, I think that what's happening right now, these conversations that are taking place, these articles being written and posted are good, right? Because it is something that since, you know, I started my career, certainly, obviously like way before me, that we talk about all the time, you know? And so it's kind of like, oh, who knew that this was even a thing? It's like, oh yeah, this has been a thing. It's been a thing, you know, as long as, you know, we've been in these spaces. So for that reason, I think that these conversations are good because people are starting or people are recognizing things that maybe they didn't realize or recognize before. And so, you know, then it's just kind of like what to do about it.
Yeah. I used the word redemption very early on in this conversation. I think the redemption is going to come in the midst of those conversations. And I think any redemption that we can sort of achieve at an organizational level, at the end of it, you know, just you sitting across the table from a donor and at an organizational level and at a very macro level, I think we have so relied upon everything else. Mm-hmm. And if we're not having these conversations, mm-hmm. I think that's one of the differences, but again, I think the branding and marketing sort of generation in our profession and like the greater world has sort of, we've removed all the vulnerability in the way that we communicate. Well, now you're seeing a lot of people hopping on things like podcasts and just having conversations,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
and not editing out the vulnerability that comes from just having a conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that's what fundraising owes itself, is we've set up, you know, you think about an event, somebody, you know, that's something, and we'll end on this thought, but special events, for example, mm-hmm. right? Somebody said this, maybe it was even an exchange with you via email or something, but, you know, we have historically relied on special events very heavily, right. But to have a more diverse and equitable and inclusive sort of community of donors, those events may have to, the character of those events may have to evolve and change. And I think that's some of the, we've essentially designed all of our event calendars like these performances. And they've performed to a particular audience, right? And if we don't allow that to perhaps evolve, and perhaps just become a little bit more real and more organic and natural.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that my wife and I, we don't get invited to a lot of events,
no.
But you know, I don't know that we're going to want to go, you know, the events that my parents or my grandparents would have gone to.
Yeah.
I don't know that we want to go to them, and I don't know that you'd want to go to them either.
Yeah. probably not. Yeah. So yes, in all aspects of our work. And again, it's not something that's going to, like, you know, obviously change overnight. And, but it is, if you don't, if it doesn't personally kind of like impact you, it's hard, I think, sometimes to see it. I remember going to a baseball game, and I was living in Cincinnati at the time, Cincinnati Reds game. And sports is not my thing, but, you know, my team was going, so I went to the game. And so one of the guys was like, "Oh, let's stand up and do, you know, whatever," he said, "do something crazy." And I was like, "I am not standing up and doing anything crazy. There is not another Black person for 3 miles. I mean, like, if you just like look down to the audience," and he was like, "Oh my gosh, there are no other." I mean, even he just kind of like looked around where we were sitting. Yeah. And just like, there are no Black people. And he didn't recognize it because he was a part of the majority. So he didn't even realize that I was, I mean, you know, he worked with me every day. So it's not like, you know, he was used to me. But it is, you know, obviously when I walked into the stand or the stadium,
yes,
I obviously noticed that there were like very few Black people, and none where we were sitting. But I think that you know, it's the recognition, like recognizing these things that have before been easy to not, you know, going to a gala and then like not realizing that like nobody else here, like, you know, or one person or two, you know, type of thing. Before I started my own fundraising consulting firm, I would get an assignment, and the first thing I would do is to go look at the website and look at the board and look at the team, look at the staff. And because I wanted to know what I was walking into. And I had worked for 5 years probably before I worked with any organization with any Black or brown people on its board or on its team. Not kidding. Like multiple clients and no diversity up and down all over the United States in some of the Blackest areas in the country. And no. So, but of course, again, they probably didn't even think about it or recognize it, realize it. But I was, you know, being sent into these spaces.
Should you not have signed on for those roles?
No.
Or
I don't regret it at all.
You don't? Okay. No, okay.
No. Yeah.
Did you contribute more to them than they quote unquote contributed to you in terms of you? Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, it's hard to say because, you know, so obviously I in any profession, the longer you do this work and different types of work and this, you know, you learn and you grow and you see what different people are doing and you carry that with you and you take it to the next, you know, assignment. So obviously I learned a lot just across the course of my career by that way. But there were conversations that I wasn't afraid to have. And those people who, you know, we can be vulnerable and like just have these conversations like, why don't Black people like people to touch their hair? Why Black women don't let people touch their hair? You know, and it'd be like, okay, gather around the table, folks. Let me tell you the history of Black women and not liking people to touch their hair. You know, and you know, obviously like learning experience with them because again, they had not worked with Black people at all. So,
right.
And a lot of them were like good friends, you know, and still now. But yeah, I would like to say that I, you know, helped in some way bring to the table, a different perspective. And, I don't regret it at all. You know, having gone into those spaces, I think, it was hard, like, to not have, you know, like I said, the mentors. I was moving to these different locations, too. So it was a whole bunch of, you know, craziness happening, like moving to new locations to work with new clients. And working with new clients that were completely shocked that a Black woman was walking through their door to tell them how to lead their fundraiser, you know. So, you know, it was a lot mixed up in there. But I don't regret it at all. I like to think that... I helped in some small way introduce a different perspective that hopefully they learned from too.
Yeah, I think that's what we need more and more of. Tiffany, this is probably going to be the longest recording that we're going to broadcast on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, but I am more than happy to afford you that. we will definitely afford you that that spot on the lineup. If there is anybody who is listening to today's conversation, we've said a lot. We've talked a lot about a lot of different things, and they want to reach out to you and have a conversation themselves. How would you suggest that they do that?
I would say the best way is to, there's a contact us on our website. It's, T as in Tiffany, J Marie, M-A-R-I-E consulting.com. Contact us. And, if you fill that out, somebody will be in contact with you. I'm also on LinkedIn, Tiffany, LinkedIn, you know, /in/ Tiffany M. Williams. So, I'm around, just find me.
Find you. Okay. Tiffany, it has been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. All you've got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion. Certainly proven to have that today. So it's been a delightful conversation. We'll look forward to having you back.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Jason. We'll talk later.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.